Morning, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith. I don't know. I haven't introduced myself for ages.
No, anyway, I'm Rachel Smith.
Just so you two guys know. And a warm welcome to our special guest on the podcast this morning, Ryan Storer from SVP Media Activation from Essence. Yeah.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
That's good. Did I get your surname right?
Just about. Well done.
Oh, just
usually,
about.
Nearly strangled it.
Usually takes two or three takes.
Pro. And Lindsay Rowntree.
Hi.
How's it going over there, Lindsay?
Really well, thank
Excellent.
You.
Excellent. Yeah. And it's back to business as usual with our normal sound guy. Obviously, last week we were in Stockholm enjoying the comfort of Mindshare's podcast recording studio. But we had to share a microphone, Lindsay. That didn't actually work out that well, I didn't think.
It wasn't great, actually.
No.
Because you hog it.
I think that's unfair. It was a bit like karaoke, basically. You know how there's always someone that wants to hold on to the microphone. Anyway, forgive us, Ryan. Right, let's dive into news stories for this week. The first news story I wanted to chat with you guys about was to do with TikTok, video streaming app that everybody is familiar with, I'm quite sure, particularly if you have children and teenagers in your life. The company is looking to expand its product offerings across e-commerce games, music streaming, and financial services. So I thought this was particularly interesting because it feels as though this is a sort of a direct effort to compete with some of the incumbents in that space, the likes of what we often refer to as sort of growing, burgeoning super utility apps. So Tencent's owned WeChat and WeChat Pay, Alipay, obviously Spotify, but then other platforms that are looking to branch out into personal and financial services, the likes of Grab, Gojek, and as I said, other super utility app platforms. Advertiser interest from brands within the TikTok environment is growing, particularly because influencers are becoming even more popular. And also the platform's developed a self-service functionality so people can go in there and target audiences in the way that they want to. They've got, you know, sort of age, geography and interest profiles. So it feels to me like this is TikTok really staking out a claim on growing their advertising business in 2020. I mean, that seems like perhaps an obvious thing for this business to do, but I'm really interested in your perspective, particularly Ryan, from an agency point of view, you know, what is this doing to the sort of advertisers' opportunities to advertise in that type of environment, and is this another example of an environment that isn't perhaps dependent on third party cookie targeting that's offering some opportunities for brands and advertisers from a targeting point of view? What's your view on this?
Yeah, I have a lot of views on the topic of TikTok, and I think The question in all the context you added there is really, can we expect TikTok's ad revenues to grow through 2020? My short answer to that is almost certainly yes. The question really become how much and how quickly. Okay. A lot of the context you shared there was in reference to the improvements they're making and the capabilities of their own advertising capabilities. From what I'm seeing, they are doing a good job of responding to requests coming through from advertisers and from agencies around better targeting capabilities, adding verification support, which is on the roadmap for this year. There's some questions, partly there's a brand safety question that they need to answer. I do see them taking strides. If anything, in the short term, that's probably the one thing that really holds them back most. But again, I do see them making strides to bring the functionality. They've hired some very good talent in the tech team, so I do see them investing in a big way. A couple questions in terms of the longevity. You know, this time 2-3 years ago, we were having a similar conversation around Snapchat. Two questions in my mind. Will age really scale? I think they have a degree of differentiation in their audience at a younger end, particularly with Gen Z. A lot of the usage, the stereotype usage you see of the TikTok platform is someone doing their best pop star impression in their living room. I come from a different generation, but I can't understand why I would want to subject anyone I know to that kind of short form video.
We're with you there, Ryan.
Right? But again, I'm not in that generation, so yeah. Who knows? Yeah. So I suppose my question here is, like, will that audience advantage hold true as that Gen Z audience gets older?
Yeah. Right?
And that's really a key thing in the social media space. It's so dominated by Facebook. When you're planning media, you're always asking yourself a question, am I getting a unique audience relative to what I would get from a single partner in what you have in Facebook's inventory network? And if that answer is yes, then that's going to really go back to the question of how fast they can grow and how quickly they can grow.
Yeah. When you're asking that question, what steps you have to take to answer it?
it's a question we put to them is one for a start. And so you referenced the advantage that they have with data. So it's a question that's tough for us to answer ourselves. There is the degree of overlap that we can measure in how ads are served. But we do also look to our partners like a TikTok and a Facebook and Nielsen and such, the others, to help give us the lay of the land in terms of which users are using which platforms. Okay. Rachel, you referenced the kind of cookie-less approach that they have and the ambition of having a more kind of omnipresent app infrastructure. I think that does make sense. I think what they're really clocking onto, and this is me kind of observing from a distance, is the ubiquity of their ecosystem is going to really, from a user perspective, the more value that their app ecosystem creates to the end user, the stronger their data proposition becomes. And let's not forget that Facebook and others are in the position that they're in, partly because they have the strongest data, and that's powered by the value that they generate for the users who use their products. So in terms of strategy, I do think it's a sensible one, and what TikTok seems to be doing is very much along those lines.
Interesting. And so is it going to be a case of, the question about what their growth trajectory will look like in 2020, is it potentially going to be a case of advertisers just feeling like they need to be there because everybody's there and they're not even, and going back to the sort of data angle, what audiences do they actually have? How verifiable is their data? Will it just be a case, or not just, but will it partly be a case of advertisers feeling like they've got to play around in that ecosystem because it is kind of the next big thing on the block?
Yeah, I mean, in the short term, there's always a degree of the new kid on the block or the shiny new toy to play with, right? There is a degree of that will work in their favor, but that's only ever a short-term item. The longevity, or will it stand the test of time, will largely be on the user growth figures and how differentiated that is relative to other platforms. The other fact in the short term, I should probably really underline it, is they do need to make some strides in terms of bringing targeting, in particular exclusion criteria, online, just to make sure that advertisers feel safe. So whilst it is the kind of the shiny new toy, at the same time, we don't want to go... When you test drive the car, you want to make sure it's not going to break down.
Yeah, of course. Right? Yeah. So this sort of needs to prove a little bit of maturity in the ad products that it's offering in that sense to make brands feel safe and comfortable. It feels like there's potentially though a lot more here if they're looking to offer a sort of plethora of other interaction points and services within that platform as well, right? So we know TikTok for its streaming capabilities, video streaming capabilities, excuse me.
Are you right there, Rachel? Some water?
Just quietly dying in the background.
Okay, good to know.
Everything's under control. Nothing to see here. Imagine if it starts offering things well beyond even sort of e-commerce and games, which seems to be the next logical step. Imagine if it does go into personalized services and banking services. I mean, that is much more down the line that we've seen, I must say, quite characteristic of a lot of Asian super utility apps, where people are perhaps almost have the expectation, users in that region almost have the expectation that they should be able to open one app and do a multiplicity of things, not just sort of a collection of things, if you know what I mean. Do you think there's going to be, some really interesting areas to watch as they expand in those
potentially
fields?
I think what you may be describing there is partly regional as well, in terms of user expectations, also comfort levels as well. Like, so for example, the UK and much of EMEA, financial services need to be very clearly decoupled from retail, for example, and for very good reasons. So what you're describing may well hold true as a growth strategy, but I suspect that will likely be regional as opposed to global.
Yeah. What do you think, Lindsay? Are we going to see a different TikTok in Asia versus Europe and the US?
Yeah, I think we probably will. I mean, we've talked in previous weeks about how TikTok is trying to grow their Western audience, and they're doing so, and they're trying to look at advertiser revenue, trying to understand how they can potentially create a different platform within TikTok to entice these big money advertisers and make them feel they're advertising in a brand safe environment. That's very much, I think, dedicated towards the Western audience versus the Eastern audience. And I think that we talk a lot about super apps because we have a very Asian focus and we have a strong Asian audience as well. And they're so prevalent in that region that whenever we're talking about them, anything happening in a Western standpoint, like Facebook doing something similar, everybody in Asia is going, oh, my God, really? Like, we've been doing this for years. Like, what is the big deal? And I feel like we're not ready in these markets to... we're not ready for a super utility app yet necessarily. There's talks about RCS, which is what Android's bringing out. So the RCS, kind of the new text messaging platform that could actually enable these services too, enable us to be able to pay via them, be able to do other services too that they're so used to doing in the APAC region. But I do feel that TikTok probably won't go down that route in this region because it won't, the uptake will be too, won't be strong enough. And I think largely a lot of that is down to a lot of the legacy that exists within different markets across Europe and across North America. Legacy in terms of payment platforms, legacy in terms of what we're used to.
Regulations, absolutely.
There's going to be too many different regulations from market to market that I think they're going to struggle with. So for them, for now, it feels like TikTok is a social platform and it will be a social video streaming platform for us anyway. Maybe in APAC, they will look down these routes because that makes logical sense. Maybe they weren't even thinking about it from a cookieless environment, but it makes sense from that perspective too. But it's just the everyone's so used to having everything in one place that actually can TikTok continue to scale if it just does one thing? In that market, in that region, maybe it can't. Maybe in this region, it can't either. And maybe that's where they're looking for new things. But yeah, I don't know. It feels like it would need to be two different entities.
What's interesting about this, though, as well, is if we think about how, you know, what the influences for change might be in any ecosystem, it's quite often, you know, early adopters and usually of a particular demographic. So if the bulk of users for TikTok outside of Asia and perhaps even within Asia at the moment are younger people, Gen Zs, did we call them, or below? What letter are we up to?
Z.
I'm stuck on Z.
Okay, yeah. Good.
Z, sorry.
Yeah. ZZ.
What's after Z?
A.
Back to the start. What will be next? ZA or something, or ZZ?
Probably. God. We'll probably start to get into double Zs and
columns
things.
Columns in Excel.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really going to, our formulas are really going to struggle then. But I'm thinking, if they might be the influencers for change, could things be different globally once teenagers get to a point where they're able to do some banking transactions on TikTok and that becomes normal for them, right? So you're quite right. I think both of you are quite right that this is representative. The way that they're describing these additional list of services that they might offer within the platform very much paints a picture of a super utility app, very much feels like that's originated in Asia. But it could change. It could change everyone's perspective. If young people pick it up quickly enough, if the sort of regulatory rules around certain industries make it possible, if parents are comfortable enough for their teenagers to be, you know, undertaking transactions, financial transactions in TikTok.
Yeah.
Might we all be doing that in
the
another year's
perspective,
time?
Aren't
that's
we?
The thing.
Well,
like,
that's it. I mean, in all honesty, we may not be qualified to answer that question, right? Like, we have a Google assistant, a Google Home in our house as a virtual assistant, and I'm not comfortable. It's not second nature for me to talk to it and ask it for a recipe or anything like that. I have to make a conscious effort to go and do so. My son's 5 years old and he's grown up where it's perfectly okay to speak to a device and he just does it out of habit. He has actually quite a lot of fun asking it to play a song. And that's his generation.
Yeah.
Right? So I think it's tough to predict what Gen Z is going to do and how they're going to behave 5-10 years from now. Given that we have such a conscious bias in that opinion.
So. It's so true. And actually, you have conversations with people. I mean, I don't have children, but actually conversations with people like you, Ryan, that say, yeah, my 5-year-old's doing this. I had a chat with someone recently who works for an agency in Finland who said my 7-year-old has probably never seen a linear TV ad because they've never watched linear TV. Like, we don't really watch it. We stream everything. If we stream everything, they stream everything even more because he's using a phone, a tablet. I'm not going to say I'm buying him all these technology solutions, but we have them in the household. He will never have seen a linear TV ad. And that to me is like, oh, yeah, I guess that's normal now. But that just feels alien to me.
Totally. And it makes me, that example that you just gave, Ryan, it makes me feel really kind of like us old folks. I don't want to group the two of you in the same age category as me, but it makes me feel slow because I feel exactly the same way. It's like I've actually even turned off the voice assistant functionality on my Sonos because it creeps me out. It's like, what, we take a long time to change our habits. Young people just go, yeah, what, you know. Particularly children, I suppose.
Yeah, well,
they're not necessarily aware of the dangers, as it were.
No, exactly. I mean, I do have everything connected, but I feel like...
Do you speak to devices and stuff?
Yeah, but I only really turn the lights
natural?
Off or turn the radio on.
Yeah,
I can't
right.
get to anything else. I might ask questions sometimes just because I can't bother to pick my phone up. But
yeah.
They're arbitrary things. Because also, let's be honest, like smart speakers aren't that intelligent yet either.
Well, that's another thing. The technology is not as impressive as you'd want it to be, really.
Exactly. Yeah. They know what's been programmed into them. They're still very human dependent in terms of that. And actually, there's still a long way for that to go. So in terms of what we would want to do with it versus a child asking for it to play a song, maybe there's still a lot to be said for the development there as well.
Of the technology, yeah, totally. Nevertheless, TikTok's advertising business is going to grow in 2020. I think we're all in agreement on that.
It massively will.
Yeah, totally. It'll be really interesting to watch how that plays out. Okay, second story of the week I wanted to chat through with you guys is the proposal of a, in air quotes, fifth cookie by a coalition of companies. Axiom, Anosis, I'm going to pronounce that, and global think tank, the Information Accountability Foundation. They've all grouped.
That was a mouthful, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But I got through it.
Well done.
Well done, me. Thank you. They've combined their energies and efforts in response to, partly in response, I would say, to the ICO's report into the RTB ecosystem, which was released last year, and then further subsequent updates were released towards the end of the year. The idea here is that the coalition is going to look at the sort of technical infrastructure and the organisational infrastructure around the RTB ecosystem, and specifically the ways in which data is collected, gathered, stored, used and applied. And the principle being that they want to come up with a suggested way forward for the industry that's GDPR compliant, and that I suppose allays some fears and anxieties about that transaction across parties and organisations relating to data. Now, I can see that the premise of this is trying to sort of get ahead of inevitable ICO rulings and findings anyway, because there's certainly been enough commentary and warning, I suppose, coming from the ICO about how they view RTB and how they view how the ad tech industry is behaving and operating within the ecosystem. But I'm just interested to know whether you guys think this is a viable approach and a viable way forward. I also am interested in your opinions on how it aligns or not with other industry initiatives and with what other companies and organisations within the ad tech and martech ecosystem might be doing, because it strikes me that, you know, it's a great idea to certainly be well prepared and get ahead of where we think the regulators are going to go with this. But it feels like everyone's making an effort to do something here. So, you know, which cart are we going to be attaching the horse to? And, you know, whose initiatives are gonna fly, and who decides what we ought to be adhering to? Is this going to be the voice of reason within chaos, or is this just going to be another layer of potential chaos? Ryan?
I mean, you asked for an opinion there. I have a lot of questions that I'm trying to navigate to in order to form an opinion. Yeah. Like, first of which, we pull up, because there's a lot of organizations trying to do similar things here. If we really pull up, first question I want to address is, or ask, I should say, is who is this benefiting? I can definitely see the benefit for the ad tech community. Does it benefit the end user? So I think we got to look at the spirit of all of the changes that have come through, whether it be browser enforced or regulatory or otherwise. The common denominator in all of that is trying to create a better internet for the end user who is consuming content, right? That's what it boils down to.
Yep.
At the end of the day, that end user, they don't care about cookies. The average person doesn't really know what a cookie is or what it does. However, they do care around their privacy and how their data is being used and modeled for re-engaging with them. So I think we need to think around being really, really clear as to who this is serving and how. And if it's not the end user, then there's always going to be question marks in my mind as to whether or not this is the real solve.
Yeah, on the right way forward. Yep. Lindsay?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that we've talked about this in the past as well. And it's come up a lot that actually we shouldn't be creating something that benefits ad tech ultimately, which Ryan was basically what you alluded to just there as well. The whole point of creating a solution that that isn't a hack or a workaround to the denigration of the third party cookie within the browser is that it's something that is useful for the user, useful for everybody, not just ad tech, because it should be created by somebody that's not connected to ad tech, but somebody completely impartial. And that, I think, is ultimately where we're getting to. And there are too many people trying to create their own solutions that will not ultimately get adopted. Because they're just, like, you refer to it as chaos. There's just more and more chaos. There's no opportunity within this chaos.
We quite literally just talked around how TikTok is sat on powerful cookieless data that they've built because they clearly provide value to end users, right? This fifth cookie proposal is designed to be set alongside Google, Facebook, Amazon's first party cookies, as I understand it. It is another cookie to solve for a world without cookies, which I find a little bit of a paradox, but there we are. Yeah. At the end of the day, if we're talking about the rise of TikTok and other ecosystems as such, that being cookieless and having the most powerful data, like is another cookie solution really going to challenge that? In the long haul, I'm really not sure.
Yeah, you're right, actually, because actually bringing another cookie into the equation doesn't solve anything. No. It feels like they're bringing a cookie into the equation because it's what we've known for so long. But even then, the cookie was not designed or created for the use of ad tech to be able to advertise to unwitting consumers. So this is not... I don't see this as being the solution.
It potentially still serves as a distraction from the real fact of the matter, which is, as you say... All sort of solutions in the world of advertising and marketing technology should have the end user experience at the core somewhere. And actually, we can't avoid the fact that targeted advertising and marketing needs to be done from the point of view of having a first party relationship somewhere in that chain that is directly, sort of linked, as it were. And I guess while we're still playing around with proposing solutions that are cookie-based, we're just distracting ourselves from that. Yeah.
Mm. You referenced Rearc as a parallel industry solution.
The IAB's initiative, yeah.
Now, my understanding, the mechanics of both Rearc and the fifth cookie proposal are both very much in the design phase. But they do seem to be philosophically a little bit different. My understanding of reading up on the Rearc proposals is that it is based on a permanent identifier, whereas the cookie is very much cookie-based.
Yeah, so the permanent identifier being the email, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like that strikes me as more compelling, largely for the reason that I think we got to think where that data is going to be coming from. And I think this is where publishers will be getting... more control of their own destiny, I think, is probably a nice way of framing it. Because going back to that statement around where do the users get the most value, and it's at the end of the day, it's through quality content experiences that they have. Publishers are increasingly looking to get users signed in. They get that data without the need necessarily for a cookie. That can then be used. We can activate that today on a publisher-to-publisher basis, which is great. That is a very powerful first-party solution that is cookie-less. However, the big drawback at the minute is scale. If the ad tech community can come together to solve the scale challenge, that's what I would love to see.
Interesting. Do you find that you're having conversations with any of your clients about this?
Yes.
Yes.
Every client wants to understand the roadmap for the years ahead, which is difficult because I don't think anyone's got a crystal ball that can really predict every change.
But it's funny you say that because we have these conversations obviously with a lot of different agencies, and every agency has a different response to what their clients are doing and reacting. And some agencies have said that their clients have not asked. Some agencies said their clients are completely freaking out. Others are coming at them with more measured questions. And it's the question about, is it because my client isn't educated? My client doesn't care? My client doesn't know? Like, what is the reasoning behind it? But actually the fact that your clients are coming to you and wanting to know not just what the hell's going on, but actually what the roadmap looks like it says a lot, I guess, about your clients to a certain degree.
They want to have skin in the game in creating it as well. We're quite fortunate to have a very good set of clients who are A, hungry to stay ahead of the curve, and B, are technically savvy enough to be able to kind of join us on the journey. They're also happy for us to experiment and learn on the fly, which is we're in incredibly privileged positions working with some of the clients that we have.
Do they think you have inside knowledge as well? Because one of your big clients, of course, is Google.
It's Google.
It's public knowledge. I haven't just shared something. Do they think, these guys will know. They'll have the inside track.
Look, I wish we knew.
Comment. I think the words you're looking for there, Ryan.
There you go. Thank you, Rachel.
What I was going to ask, though, about that, and forgive us, listeners, because we're sort of steering already into second part of the podcast territory, but indulge us for a minute, is because you said you're working with clients who are, quite proactive in trying to understand the roadmap and so forth, do you think that that's coming from a perspective of wanting to have the end user, at the forefront of this conversation? So I'm thinking from a brand's perspective, they care mostly about their customers and their potential customers, right? And so if they're thinking about an advertising experience, are they thinking about that from the point of view of this could be my next potential customer, and so this is the way I want that campaign, that process to be designed, this is the way I want to be trying to acquire them? Do you think that's where that's coming from?
The short answer to that is yes. That's very much the ethos behind things. But I'd add that none of this is necessarily in direct response to GDPR or cookies crumbling or anything to that effect. And we've been very much on this journey for years now. And you know, if I rewind even a year prior to GDPR coming into effect, our dependency on third-party data was very little. We'd very much already been through the journey of proving that first-party data assets are far more effective than third-party, and also finding that tapping into partners' data, whether it be publishers or Google's or Facebook's, also powerful and often more powerful than third-party data. So our kind of direction of travel in our data ecosystem was already very much moving in this direction. If anything, this has really just kind of push us to accelerate plans to make first party more prominent in what we do. And the conversations we have are similar to as you described, Rachel, around making sure we have that clear value proposition with our customer's customer. Okay. So that the end user understands the role of advertising and how that's beneficial to them. So that we do take them on the journey where we're thinking of customer value, authentic relationships over the longer term, as opposed to one-off transactions.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. One other question I've got for both of you on this particular story is that if we accept that actually the solution here, when we're talking specifically about sort of re-engineering the ad tech ecosystem and looking particularly at RTB-related technology, if we accept that it's better reworked from the point of view of having the user perspective at heart, who is rightly placed in the industry to be doing that? We sort of had this conversation a little bit on the podcast last week.
Yeah.
And I raise it because, you know, Lindsay, you made a very good point that agencies' perspective of how much clients are involved in this discussion or engaged by this discussion vary, because we had a really interesting conversation on stage at ATS Stockholm last week where we had a range of agency views, some of them even saying, do you know what, I'm not really bothered about you know, cookieless environments and what targeting is going to look like beyond here, because I'm quite sure the industry will be able to solve it. I mean, I'm paraphrasing a bit, but you know, I think we've got this under control. Not I think we've got this under control, but whatever the solution is, we'll be able to find it. It will be okay. So my question back to you guys is, if we accept that there needs to be a way that the technology side of the industry changes and it needs to be designed from a user point of view, who do we need to be engaging to make sure we get that right?
I think everyone's got to have some degree of skin in the game, but I think the most obvious starting point for me is probably the consent management platforms and publishers. I think that, and the reason I say that is very much the front line. And we are in the situation we are in with the regulation serves a purpose, right? And it's in the interest of giving users a better experience. And the irony is a lot of consent management platforms, the way they kind of pop up and the degree intrusive, and they worsen the experience, which is the irony in it all. But I think we're missing a trick here at the minute, and that is the internet is good for society. Quality content is good for society. And the majority of that is ad-funded. Okay, but I'm not quite sure that we are very effective as an advertising industry, the irony, articulating that to
value.
The end user.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot, don't we?
Yeah, we do. I think that's a fair point, actually. I think that my view on this is changing as people's perceptions of what a cookieless environment means. Because at the beginning, there was a lot of moaning. And there was moaning about the fact that Google, for example, had gone to W3C and said, help us find a solution, and the advertisers and agencies have gone, well, hang on, what about us? Why aren't we involved in this conversation?
Yeah.
Like, it was a lot of whining and crying over spilt milk. Mm. And from that reaction, it kind of felt like you don't deserve to be part of this conversation, because it's not about you, it's about the end user. That's what it's been created for. A bit like a conversation with a fifth cookie. Like, it's not designed, it shouldn't be something designed by ad tech for ad tech. So actually, it should be something where there needs to be a really broad working group, you know, just a giant GitHub for this kind of thing where everybody actually is able to contribute. But it has to be something that's rational and not everyone moaning about, well, this is how it negatively impacts me. No. We're done with that. Yeah. We all know how you're going to be impacted.
This is all an opportunity to make advertising more effective. Better.
Exactly. Yeah.
For everyone in the ad economy. We need a much more sustainable ad economy that works for the end user, for publishers, for advertisers and ad tech.
Yeah.
That's the place we need to get to. Yeah. I think there's an opportunity in front of us to do so. I think it begins with how we articulate the value of advertising.
But we've been trying that for decades, haven't we? And that's not got us very far.
Well, I don't know if people have really been, if the industry's really been trying in earnest. You're right. We've been having a sort of versions of this conversation. We're not good at articulating the value of advertising for quite some time. But maybe the impetus is here now more than ever before.
Well, it has to be.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Everything we're describing is powered by consent. Mm. And if we do not articulate the value exchange that advertising brings, then we will not get consent. Whether it be REARC or this fifth cookie, both of those things do require consent. Fifth cookie looks like it then kind of models based on legitimate interest, which I think there'll be question marks over.
Yep.
But again, if without consent, we don't really get very far. That's the one thing we need, and we have to communicate value to end users.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, I'm going to move us on to third story of the week, which is on my behalf, a cobbling together of a couple of DTC-related stories to ask a few poignant questions about the DTC industry and the general health of it. So the first is an article that was referencing a slowdown in growth of the DTC sector. Why is it whenever I start talking, I'm the one that needs to... Quite fine when I'm not saying anything. Excuse me.
Maybe you should take that hint there.
Yeah. Thanks, Lindsay. Not to take that personally. Right. An article suggesting slowdown in growth in the DTC sector. Also an article focusing on Wayfair, the e-commerce site in the US, continuing to lay off staff as a result of profitability issues and really struggling to get to profitability. And then another article that was referencing, as an example, Target making it to the list of top 10 US e-commerce retailers. And in that top 10 list, you were seeing classic e-commerce companies such as Amazon and eBay, but you were also seeing alongside them these legacy retailers, Target and Walmart, included in that as well. So what I wanted to ask you guys is, are we seeing a slowdown in growth for DTC businesses? We've also talked a little bit about some DTC businesses going out of business. What did we talk about last week? Brandless going out of business. And, you know, there's been quite a lot of talk in the media about whether the sort of explosive growth of DTC businesses that we were all chatting about last year, whether that was sustainable. So are we starting to see the, you know, downward curve of that trajectory? Is it actually a story about the age old, I suppose, what do we call it, rules of advertising and marketing? Is it a story about brand versus customer acquisition? And are we seeing that perhaps DTC businesses or challenger brands are not investing as much time and effort in building their brand as they are in acquiring an initial cohort of customers, and how sustainable is that? And is there also a story here about legacy brands and the lessons that they're taking from the e-commerce sector and also from the challenger brand DTC sector? And are we seeing some of those lessons pay off? And is that about having brand and scale, the likes of Target and Walmart being examples of that, brands that are already existed for a very long time? Or is it a case that they're opportunistic and our shopping habits have changed so significantly that they're just riding the wave of what is ultimately a change in the way the retail sector is shaking out? Lots of questions there. Lindsay, I'm actually going to go to you first because you're doing some interesting calisthenics there in the background again. Uncomfortable in your chair.
Some back stretches there. Don't mind me.
What are your thoughts on this?
I mean, lots to unpick there, Rachel. I think that there's a lot of things here that on the one hand, you could say that, okay, the DTC bubble is bursting. On the other hand, you could look at the individual businesses that aren't doing so well within DTC and say, well, it's their fault. It's the business model that they were operating versus DTC as a whole. And on the other hand, there's a conversation around, well, the DTC brands that exist don't even want to be called DTC anymore because DTC being called DTC is limiting to them because they are realizing that there is a scale limitation when it comes to just relying on their own kind of acquisition focused e-commerce and going after other areas such as wholesale agreements with retailers, suppliers, either in store or online, and also doing creating their own stores as well, be they pop up or permanent fixtures. And there's the, you know, for example, on our DTC podcast, we had Pat Coffee in, and they've relied heavily on their subscription model. And that subscription model is brilliant because it's recurring revenue for them. But even they accept that they have to look at other areas. And their e-commerce store, which allows you to buy one pack of coffee as a one-off, is a massive opportunity for them. And that's where they will see their new revenue, because they appreciate that by now we're 7 years old. Everyone has seen a Pat Coffee ad. Everyone who has subscribed is already subscribing. This is where we need to be able to find growth, and maybe they will subscribe, and that's where we grow our user base, but that's the new opportunity for us. So I think it's just maybe it's an evolution of what DTC looks like, and that's a great way to start a business, but it's not a great way to continue a business.
There's also a DTC stereotype in there that to be DTC you need to be the startup, that the disruptor, so to speak.
Yeah, the challenger. Yeah,
whereas absolutely, yeah. DTC is actually becoming a bit more common practice with larger, more established brands as well, who've traditionally had the majority of the sales going via retail. But there's I'm seeing more of an ambition to own their customer relationships and going direct to customers. So there is that factor as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's a data conversation, a digital transformation conversation, and we've seen it from the likes of the tech companies like Samsung. We've seen it from the retail, from the brand clothing manufacturers like Adidas and Nike have been hot on that as well. They know their customers better than the retailers they work with do, and they want to be able to own that relationship, and that makes a lot of sense. And they can do a better job of making sales and understanding who's buying what kind of demographic they are, and how they can get them to buy again, than they can with retailers, where they frankly don't really ever get any data. So it's important for them to be able to grow those relationships. So it makes a lot of sense from that perspective. And again, that just paints the DTC label as being limiting for those bigger brands and the smaller startup brands as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ryan, what are your thoughts on this?
I really liked the Pat Coffee example. I think the reality of when you have a narrow product set or a rather niche product or service, the greater your market penetration grows, and as your customer base grows, the cost for your next customer will increase. So naturally, there's a law of diminishing returns applies to how those businesses grow. So to a certain extent, I think there's a degree of that happening here. I think there's also a degree of it just becoming a more competitive space. I mean, the access to consumers that Google Ads and Facebook advertising and Amazon as well, of course, have given to these startups has made it very easy to get started, because it gives you access to the market very quickly. Tougher to scale, because as bigger brands or more traditional established organizations start to take note, where they've traditionally been more traditional media than into digital, they're, as you said, learning the lessons from that and making it more competitive space to play in.
Yeah. And what I'm interested as well on your thoughts, Ryan, about the thought of, is it actually a case of there's DTC has now become too big for its own good, and everyone's trying to create a startup so they can get bought. It's turning into what ad tech was looking like a few years ago, where everyone was creating a startup to get bought by big tech. And it created this kind of this strange situation where nobody wanted to be able to scale a business. They wanted it to be bought after a couple of years, and they could then sit back and like reap the rewards of their efforts. It feels like it's turning to that a bit as well.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think that, you know, the example of sort of DTC mattress brands, for example, it's like how many DTC mattress businesses are sustainable in the marketplace?
I think at one point there were 220 in the US.
Which just sounds phenomenal to me, because when we started having that conversation, I was thinking, yeah, I mean, I can name sort of three or four off the top of my head, which means maybe there's got to be 10. I didn't think there'd be like 220, because, you know, firstly, what is the trajectory of a mattress buying customer anyway? And secondly, you know, how are each of those brands, they might be, I suppose the DTC world has taught us that you, like you just alluded to, Ryan, you could set up a business and get a share of voice and get a pool of customers, but what happens after that? And like you say, Lindsay, is it the case that people were attracted to starting these businesses because they thought, well, I don't really need to worry about the long term, I've just got to prove the short term, and then someone will come and save the day? And that's just getting harder and harder, particularly in an environment where shopping and retail consumption has just changed so much. What do you think it also says about our purchasing habits?
Good question. They're definitely shifting. I mean, one thing I'm wondering is how much, going back to the Pat Coffee example, is how prominent are subscription models going to be as we go forward. So if we think 10 years from now, is the, I don't think we're yet conditioned today to think, I buy this once a month, so I'm just going to subscribe to it and take the hassle out of shopping altogether. So I think that's going to play a role. As and when we get to that space, it's kind of the e-commerce layer in between the DTC and the end transaction that kind of interests me, as the DTC concept has really risen out of being able by e-commerce platforms, whether it be in Amazon or otherwise. We're now seeing Facebook's following suit, bringing e-commerce formats to market. Pinterest is bringing e-commerce experience to market. Google Shopping is not new, but is making strides to shorten the path to a transaction, not dissimilar to what Amazon's done. So I'm kind of interested to see what happens in terms of owning the customer relationship in the space, because if it's plausible, and it very much is, if you look at Amazon, the shopping experience, you begin your search, your comparison, your transaction, all happens in the one place, and that is it's kind of Amazon owning that data and that relationship probably more than the end brand is. And you can kind of see a similar situation emerging elsewhere. So where DTCs have risen out of kind of owning that consumer relationship, is that actually going to be plausible in the long term? That's something that we've got to kind of wait and see. So I think the answer to your question, my rather long-winded there.
I love a long-winded answer.
It kind of depends, and it's partly on user behaviors in the e-commerce space more so than with regards to DTC brand specifically.
Yeah, I'd really agree with that. You've phrased that in a really interesting way, because if I think about just even my own habits, so I am a subscriber to Smol. We talked about Smol last week as well.
We did.
So dishwashing tablets and washing machine tablets.
Laundry thank detergent. You. Dishwashing tablets and washing machine.
This is a bit like letter post or slot. Anyway, yeah. I'm not even going to explain that. It's just, I'm going to blame my Australian heritage. Anyway, but the point is, I can't get the subscription bit of it right? Because you start off by saying, well, this is how many washes I do a week, and this is kind of what my lifestyle is like. And then they go, okay, well, so we estimate that maybe you need a delivery like once every 6 weeks. Well, no, I don't actually. That's way too frequently. So then I pause it, and then I pause the wrong one. And then next thing you know, I've got 10 million packs of dishwasher tablets and no laundry detergent. I'm like, oh, this is harder than just going to the supermarket and buying it myself. Now, that's obviously user error first and foremost. But
you need a virtual assistant. That'll solve it.
Yeah, there you go. But also, I kind of think, actually, if all of that was sort of a bit more, because I like the idea, I'm very happy with the idea of a subscription service for that sort of renewable purchase that you're going to need all the time. But actually, if that was available in a bit more of a sophisticated environment and I could do lots of different things, i.e. it was in an e-commerce platform, I might feel a bit differently about it. So actually, a little bit like our TikTok conversation, e-commerce has definitely taught us to consume things and shop for things in a different way. And I definitely think that's having an impact on other DTC businesses and brands as they kind of try to grow and scale.
It is. I mean, I subscribe to one thing, and that is Itchpet for my dear dogs, flea and worm medication, because they need to be administered every month and every 3 months. So it's perfect.
It's a
because
known
when
thing.
It arrives, I'm like, I need to administer his flea medication. But that I can't make it work for anything else. And then I subscribe for 1 month and then forget to cancel it. And then these things keep arriving. I'm like, what am I paying for? I've got no idea what's going on.
Yeah, that's it.
But it's all too complicated. And also, like the convenience of it is kind of falling out of favor with people. I think they're finding it frustrating. And, you know, to use the Wayfair example, I've used Wayfair. Wayfair is a pain in the ass, frankly. It's
what was painful
about
it?
You've got no idea. Well, you've got no idea. Shopping on it is annoying. And when you shop on it, they harass you via notifications, via emails, via whatever method they possibly can. Carrier pigeon, probably. Like you're just harassed by Wayfair all the time, wherever you go, for things that you don't want to buy. It drives me mad.
Wayfair, take note.
Yeah, absolutely. But then
this
but then
is why
also
your profitability is waning.
The delivery is can be frustrating because it can be delivered anytime between 3 and 10 days. And obviously it's furniture based, so you've got no idea when it's arriving, when it's like how it's going to be delivered. There's no it's a very frustrating service. So I think there are other options that people find easier than using a Wayfair type service. That points to potential business model rather than just DTC, the DTC-ness of it falling out of favour.
It's interesting though, because Wayfair has done a good job on the branding side of things, which we've kind of
absolutely
glossed over. You mentioned, but we
good old Lorraine Kelly.
We've glossed over. What's interesting for me, if I go back to the point around where the e-commerce experience happens, and if you live on whether it be an Amazon or a Google or an e-commerce kind of environment domain end to end, previously to be a DTC, you set up a website, you drive traffic to the website, right? And you know, GoDaddy built a great business off of that kind of principle. But if that click to website stops occurring, that the brand element becomes less important, and all of a sudden the value proposition in here becomes much more centered around things like your pricing, your logistics, which is exactly what you just described with Wayfair. They kind of put brand ahead of logistics in what you just described.
Yeah.
Whereas it almost flips the balance there, where logistics and price, they're the things that will make you more competitive with the direction of travel on the e-commerce side of things.
Mm. Absolutely. And that's what Amazon obviously always do very well. And Amazon hold brands that work with them over a barrel if they don't use the Amazon Fulfillment Center. You have to use certain courier services, and you have to deliver up in a certain day. And if you don't, they're basically trying to get you to have everything fulfilled by Amazon so that Amazon can continue to deliver this amazing service that customers want, which makes a lot of sense, but apparently is very annoying for brands.
And in the meantime, then we all kind of get shoehorned into shopping in the Amazon way. And so that manages our expectations, which then becomes the thing that everybody needs to, every other competitor sort of needs to match up to. It is interesting, isn't it? It is changing our lives, you know, quite sort of beyond recognition in terms of shopping, and it'll be interesting to see where it all goes. I think the other interesting point you made there, Ryan, as well, is that, you know, this is I think this is the other side of just a natural kind of curve, increase in interest and sort of excitement and fascination with DTC brands. It was never going to be sustained at that same level of growth and excitement. It's kind of natural that it would plateau and potentially even drop off as things settle down, I reckon.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Cool. Okay, let's move on to, although we've, you know, really in earnest started it already, let's move on to a bit of a chat in more detail about what you're up to at Essence, Ryan.
Sure.
Maybe you can start with just telling us a little bit about what your role at Essence focuses on as SVP of Media Activation. What does that mean?
Sure thing. What does it mean? Good question. I do get asked that for a bit. In short, I run the team at Essence who delivers our media campaigns. So we get briefed. We do the tactical planning as to how the we're going to deliver on the media strategy and plan that set, and we put the wheels in motion in terms of the physical ad buying, the data strategies that go into practice, and then how we report on success after the fact. Okay, I would broadly speaking, I'd probably describe my role as T-shaped. The cross at the top being the kind of general management side of things. It is a very big team across multiple offices. It's about 300 odd people, all media practitioners.
Wow.
Looking across all media. So there is. I also sit on the Essence EMEA board. So there's a general management aspect to what I do day to day, and then the vertical kind of line in the T. Being our specialism, thinking of our media craft skills and how we articulate our differentiation, whether it be programmatic or traditional media search, etc. Okay. I'm very, very fortunate to work with some very, very skilled people in that space. So it is quite fun to kind of get to geek out on how we're designing some of the future solutions every now and then.
We love some of your geeky Essence colleagues,
yeah,
I have to say.
Absolutely.
Tell us a bit about some of the things that you've been focusing on specifically with your clients, say, over the last couple of months, maybe what your clients are particularly either concerned about or excited about in the coming, you know, year. We've already touched on some of that. But it's always interesting to us to hear a little bit more sort of directly from brands and how they're working together with their agency partners.
Yeah. One of the things I'll elaborate on is how we're thinking of applying targeting that is more respectful of the end user's privacy. I think that's incredibly important. I referenced a little bit earlier that I think we've actually been on this journey for a long time, really placing the emphasis on first party assets. Now, that's continuing to be the case. So we're in discussion with a lot of our colleagues around how they can really take ownership of their customer data and put that into directly into action. Kind of branching off of that, there's the concept of thinking around how we can be more data driven without personal data, and the the two kind of dovetail really nicely, I think. We are using more cloud-based technology to be running models across customer data sets without any personal information being exposed. And then we've built the connectors to plug that back into ad platforms. So we start to get a prediction that permeates into bidding and targeting around what we're expecting the value of the next auction with a given user to be. So building kind of bespoke algorithms off of a customer's proprietary data set is stuff that we're working on. I personally find that extremely exciting.
That is very exciting. Can you give us an insight into kind of how that works practically for, like, say an example client?
As in the mechanics of it?
Yeah.
Yes. So there's layers to it. I'll give you kind of broad strokes. The first layer is the collection layer. You do need to be collecting your customer records in an environment which is consented and compliant. Mm. From that, we connect that up to a cloud-based technology, like an ads data hub, for example, that allows us to then group the records, segment them, and run our bespoke models across them. So we start to get clusters of customers that we can predict a future value of, and then we can then apply that in retrospect. So when we enter auctions where we may not know around the user, the user is actually kind of just one data point. The reality is we still live in a very data-rich space, and there's a number of factors we can look at, whether it be the specific placement or the context, etc. So we start to build those kind of models, and so we become more predictive in our approach rather than reactive. So to go back to your question, the layers to it: one, collection; second, the aggregation and analysis; and then third, the action and auction.
Interesting.
And from sort of a brand's point of view, are there, because presumably, you know, you work with sort of different sizes of brands and clients. Yeah. So are there some points along that journey which are typically a bit of a stumbling block for most of your clients? And if so, where are they?
Yeah, going through the layers, I mean, data collection varies in its definition from client to client, right? Mm. Some of which is first-party cookie-based. Much of the data in modeling today is still third-party cookie-based. And some clients are starting to make strides in the direction of getting past the cookie and having permanent identifiers. Mm. Right. So where clients really, really differ is it's a bit more bespoke in terms of the data collection and aggregation stage. Once that hurdle's cleared, things like analysis and how that's connected into ads platforms is a bit more transferable across clients, but it's not copy-paste anywhere from client to client. Kind of going back to that data collection there, I think one of the things that we're going to be navigating both at Essence and as an industry is how the balance of data source shifts over the years to come. So at the minute you have a combination of first-party cookie data, third-party cookie data, and kind of cookie-less data, if you will. I don't think we're ever going to have like a date in the calendar where cookies no longer exist and everything is on kind of permanent identifiers.
Yeah.
But what we are going to have is a bit of a sliding scale in terms of the prominence of each. So some of our clients are working a little bit more, working faster than others for different reasons around having customers sign in, for example, to create the permanent identifier and have marketing permissioned. That gives us a kind of cookie-less object to model against and target with. Whereas others are still reliant on a cookie first or third party.
Interesting. That must be so interesting from brand to brand, right? Mm. And because are there some brands who you sort of trying to take on that journey, who've sort of embarked on it and have kind of gone, whoa, this is, you know, really hard actually. For one reason or another, they either can't get kind of signed in customer data. There's been moments where they've thought, you know, I don't know, they've even questioned whether they would actually be able to gather that kind of data.
Yeah, I mean, what I just described is riddled with challenges, both technical, commercial, political, etc.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I really quite enjoy it because at the end of the day, this is kind of why agencies exist.
Problem solving, right?
So you know, if we didn't enjoy helping clients solve difficult problems, then we should probably look for something else to do.
Totally. And, you know, we talk about this a bit when we talk about the structure of the service layer in the industry. That's also much more of a consultative approach,
right?
It is
indeed, yes.
Because that would be the moment, particularly these days, that I imagine most brands feel kind of quite exposed. They're working with you and they're going, the truth is, guys, we don't really have the capability to gather that data, or we don't know how to do it, or whatever. That's quite a, you know, bare bones, can you help us type of conversation. Yes, a lot of nodding going.
Great for podcast.
I mean, look, I think we have a duty to you describe it being as consultative. Kind of in practice, I would describe it as kind of thinking 2, 3, 5 years into the future and thinking what solutions are we going to need to help our clients future proof. Right. And I think if we can add value at that level, then that's what's going to help us build our relationships with our clients over time.
But it does require you to have a bit of a crystal ball in some regard, doesn't it, though?
Yeah, we definitely don't get it all right. Yeah. So I won't pretend to. But I think what clients appreciate is the honesty and the ambition to go out and try to drive change for the good. Okay. And most of our clients are all, we're fortunate enough to have very understanding clients and very ambitious clients.
Loud sneezing in the background. just been distracting all of us there.
In the exchange wire office, there's been screaming, there's been sneezing. Apologies.
That's Kieron when he's not even in the podcast. Yeah. He finds a way to intervene. Yeah.
Good Lord.
So, yeah, look, I think it's that journey of kind of discovery as we kind of go through digital acceleration that's really mutually rewarding for us and the clients that we work with.
And Ryan, I wonder if you can say a little bit about the sort of sell side of the transaction and kind of what work you're doing with the sell side of the business and publishers and so forth, and what your perspective on that is.
Yeah, I referenced earlier that publishers, I'm expecting publishers' data proposition to be coming stronger. Yeah. And it's largely for the reason that I think they're in a position where they have a clearer value exchange with the end user. And as that gets more signed in, we're starting to look at solutions where we can match permanent identifiers between our client's customer database and the publisher. So we get some very really tight targeting and therefore measurement off the back of solutions such as that. So great in theory, very nascent in terms of the mechanics. Today, limited in scale, so the return on effort isn't fantastic. But I do also think that we do have to plug away at solutions like this in order for them to get scale in time.
Yeah.
So like that's one of the examples. Some of the things that we're doing is we're looking at how we can personalize in the absence of any personal data whatsoever. The reality is we won't always have consent to personalize an impression, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't serve an impression, right? But our duty, however, is to make sure that the ad that we do show is beneficial to the user experience as opposed to intrusive. So we're looking at how we can get take the concept of personalizing on context and make it hyper contextual. So instead of understanding like this is someone's reading about a recipe, therefore they're interested in cooking, can we understand that actually this is how to make a lasagna? It's going to take you 3 hours, and we serve an ad saying, hey, in case you don't have 3 hours, here's the number to your nearest Italian restaurant, right? That kind of a solution that really complements the environment that the user in is at that moment in time, all kind of automated and driven by machine learning to understand the language and the really, really deep context of a page to think of how we make ads that are complementary for a user's experience.
It's really interesting because we've been talking a little bit about how this sort of shift, which, you know, as you've rightly pointed out, for many in the industry, feels like it's been sort of gradually gathering steam over a number of years, this shift in needing to focus much more on first-party data, needing to operate outside of a sort of an environment where you're heavily dependent on third-party cookie targeting, is bringing the sort of buy and sell sides of the industry a bit closer together, bringing the brand and the publisher a bit closer together. Is that something that you would reiterate?
That's absolutely happening. The example I described where we can look to match permanent identifiers across a publisher and a brand's customer database is exactly that. It brings the two much, much closer together.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so you're working with publishers directly that at the moment?
Yes.
Yeah. And did you say that that's something that needs a bit more work in order to kind of scale?
It does indeed. I think the ad tech community is coming to the party. Look at people like InfoSum, for example, really helping drive that. I referenced the return on effort challenge being a challenge that we need to navigate. I would love for some of the ad tech community to think around that. As we, from an agency perspective, there's only so much time in a day to go publisher to publisher. If we can start to bring publishers together with a common layer of ad tech, that would be something that's potentially beneficial.
Mm-hmm. You're giving advertisers and ad tech another KPI, return on effort. Yeah,
that's, I like it though.
Yeah. Well, it creates value, right?
Yeah,
I mean, ad tech should create value. It should not be a tax.
And it's interesting, kind of, it's this, do you think that advertisers should be working more to understand how publishers of running their businesses and help them with solutions to make sure that actually it's more cohesive and not just here's a publisher, here's an advertiser, here's an ad, let's put that on the page, irrelevant of what's on the page and who we're targeting.
Yeah, I think the concept you're describing there is one of partnerships, and I do think there's value in understanding their mutual customer and how they can how we can create partnerships which are beneficial all around to the publisher, to the brand, and ultimately the mutual customer.
Mm. Interesting stuff.
Fair play.
We've run out of time.
Oh dear.
Yeah. That went quickly.
It did, actually.
Absolutely flew.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Ryan, for taking the time to come and spend the morning with us, chatting through Stories of the Week. Not at all. Our pleasure. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you.
And thanks, Sound Guy. Good to be back in the right room. And that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast. Thanks for listening.